Welcome back to Faded Tales, everyone. I'm your host, Zoya, and it's been a while, yeah. I've been busy this year. I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and yeah, this is an emotional one for me, and you'll soon find out why. But today we are talking about the Great Auk, and I hope you guys enjoy. Grab a cup of cocoa, warm up on this rainy day, and enjoy this podcast. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Faded Tales. I'm your host, Zoya, and it's been a while. Yeah, I think last recorded was the 17th. Yeah, I've been busy. I didn't get to record last week. This is gonna be an emotional one because normally when it's the end of the year on this podcast, I talk about an extinct animal. All that, and just to remember why these stories are important. And this is the extinct animal script, but why it's so emotional to me is that today is going to be my last day recording with you guys. Yeah, I'm graduating in the fall. So yeah, I guess I won't be able to record anymore. And this is going to be emotional for me. Yeah, it's been fun recording for you guys. I hope everyone that listens enjoys my podcast, and yeah, thank you guys so much for this. It means a lot to me for you guys to listen. And let's get on today's episode. So this extinct animal, you might think it's a weird name. It's the great auk. So if you had ever encountered a great auk in real life, it probably wouldn't feel mysterious at first. It would feel physical, solid, present, and about the size of a goose, but standing upright with a thick body and short neck. Its back was black, its underside was white, and in breeding season, it had a distinct white patch in front of each eye. Its beak was one of the most noticeable features, large, laterally compressed, with deep grooves running across it. Not decorative, but functional, built for gripping slippery fish. And unlike most seabirds, people are familiar with, like the puffin, or say, for example, the great auk didn't fly. Its wings were reduced, small and stiff. If you saw one up close, you might even wonder how a bird like that could have ever taken off. But that's because flight wasn't its strategy anymore. The great auk was a pursuit diver. It used its wings underwater in the way other birds use them in the air, propelling itself forward, steering, accelerating. It likely hunted fish like Atlantic cod, capelin, and herring, diving to significant depths and staying submerged longer than many surface-feeding birds. And if you think this sounds familiar, it does feel like it's a penguin, but this bird did not live in the Antarctic or Arctic. On land, though, it was noticeably less capable. It stood upright, it balanced on webbed feet, set far back on its body, great for swimming, but not for walking. Its movement was slow and somewhat awkward, especially on uneven rock. And importantly, it didn't show strong avoidance behavior towards humans. That wasn't because it was trusting in a human sense. It was because for most of its evolutionary history, there was no reason to recognize humans as predators. Great auks were colonial breeders. They gathered in large numbers on specific islands during their breeding season, usually places with easy access to water, but limited access for land predators. Each pair produced a single egg per year. That's a critical detail, not a clutch, not multiple attempts, one egg. The egg was large relative to the bird's body size and laid directly on bare rock. There was no nest structure, no vegetation, no concealment, which tells us something important. These birds involved environments where egg predation was minimal. Both parents likely participated in the incubation, taking turns staying on the egg while the other foraged. And because colonies were dense, individuals would have been in close proximity, touching distance in many cases. The colony wouldn't have been quiet or serene. It would have been loud. Low calls, shuffling bodies, the sound of feet on stone, wings brushing against each other, a constant presence of movement and noise. Now, when European sailors began exploiting Great Auk colonies, they didn't need specialized hunting techniques. That's what made the species so vulnerable. Accounts suggest that people could walk directly into colonies and kill large numbers of birds quickly, often using clubs or simply just grabbing them. There was no need for nets, traps, or projectiles. In some cases, birds were driven up planks and onto ships. In others, they were killed on sight and processed immediately. And while some of the more extreme stories, like burning birds as fuel, do appear in historical records, they should be understood in context. These were likely not everyday practices, but they do illustrate how little value was placed on animals beyond their immediate utility. What matters most is the scale. Large numbers of birds were taken repeatedly from the same breeding sites over long periods of time. And because each pair only produced one egg per year, the population could never recover. The decline of the great auk wasn't just about hunting. It was about how the species lived. They relied on a small number of breeding sites, and if those sites were disturbed or overexploited, entire portions of the population could disappear at once. They reproduced slowly, which meant even moderate levels of sustained hunting could outpace population growth. And they were highly visible and predictable, returning to the same location at the same times of year. In ecological terms, they were extremely vulnerable to human pressure, even before anyone recognized that vulnerability. The last widely accepted record of the great auks comes from 1844 on Eldey Island in Iceland. By that point, the species had already disappeared from most of its former range. Three men were sent to the island to capture the remaining birds, not out of cruelty in a personal sense, but because specimens of rare animals were highly valued by collectors and institutions. They found a pair of great auks, and they killed them. The details vary slightly between accounts, but it is generally accepted that the birds were killed and that the egg present at the site was destroyed. After that, there were no confirmed sightings of the species. Okay, so when we talk about extinction, it's easy to imagine a clear moment, a final day, a last sight that everyone recognizes as significant, but for more species, including the auk, that isn't how it happened. There was no global awareness in 1844 that something irreversible had just occurred. No headlines, no coordination response, no coordinated response, and no sense at the time that this was the end. Instead, the disappearance of the great auk was fully understood in hindsight, after the colonies were already gone, after sightings stopped, after there was nothing left to observe. Even then, uncertainty lingered. There were occasional reported sightings in the years that had followed, unconfirmed, inconsistent, often based on brief or distant observations, but none were verified. And over time, these reports stopped too. Extinction, in this case, wasn't a single event. It was a process that only became visible once it was completed. When a species disappears, what's lost? The lost isn't just the animal itself. It's everything that comes with it. The great auk played a role in its ecosystem, as a predator of fish, as a prey for larger marine animals, as a part of nutrient cycles between ocean and land. Seabird colonies, especially dense ones, contributed significantly to the environments they occupy. Though waste movement and feeding patterns, sorry, through waste movement and feeding patterns, they transported nutrients from the ocean onto land. Over time, that shaped plant life, soil, composition, and even the presence of other species. Remove the birds, and those processes change. But beyond the ecological function, there's another kind of loss, one that's harder to measure. The loss of behavior, of sound, of presence. There is no way now to observe how great auks interacted in colony. No way to hear their calls directly. No way to watch how they raised their young or how they responded to changing conditions over now. What we know comes from fragments, written accounts, perceived specimens, constructed understanding, but the living system, it's gone. Looking back, the vulnerability of the great auk is clear. But at the time, those patterns weren't widely understood. Today they are. We now recognize several risk factors that made the species particularly susceptible to extinction. I've already mentioned them before, but I'm going to list them again. Low reproductive rate, one egg per year. Colonial breeding, large portions of population concentrated in one place. Limited breeding sites, only a few, very few safe locations. Flightlessness, no rapid escape from danger, and predictable behavior, returning to the same locations repeatedly. Individually, these traits aren't unusual. Many species share them. Combined, they create a system that's highly sensitive to sustained human pressure. And importantly, these same patterns exist in species today. Throughout the faded tales, we've talked about animals that are still here, but many of them share characteristics with the great auk. Species with limited habitats, species that reproduce slowly, species that rely on specific environments that are changing rapidly. The difference is timing. The great auk represents the end of a process. Endangered species represent earlier stages of that same process. And that process is not always obvious while it's happening. Populations can decline for years, even decades, before the situation is even recognized as critical. And by then, recovery becomes much more difficult. One of the more uncomfortable aspects of the great auk story is that awareness came too late, but it did come. By the early 19th century, people had already began to notice the species were becoming rare. There were efforts to document it, to collect specimens, to preserve examples of it. But those efforts didn't translate into protection, because recognizing decline is not the same as stopping it. Conservation, as we understand it today, didn't fully exist yet. There were no coordinated international protections. No legal frameworks, no widespread e-systems for monitoring population. So even as concern grew, the actions needed to reverse the trend weren't in place. It's easy to distance ourselves from stories like this, to place them firmly in the past, to see them as something that happened before we understood better. But the underlying dynamics, resource use, economic demand, delayed response, are not limited to the 18th and 19th centuries. They're still present. The difference now is that we have more information, better tools, a clearer understanding of how ecosystems function and how species decline, which also means we have less uncertainty about consequences. If you had visited one of those North Atlantic islands before large-scale hunting began, you would have encountered a functioning system, a species well adapted to its environment, stable, self-sustaining. And over time, through repeated human interaction, the system was gradually reduced until it no longer existed. Not suddenly, not dramatically, but completely. The great auk is often remembered as a symbol of extinction. But more accurately, it is an example of a process, one that can be observed, understood, and now, in some cases, interrupted. The species we've talked about throughout this podcast are still within that process, which means their outcomes are not fixed. So if you guys want to, I really hope you guys want to spread the word about endangered animals. is because we have a job to do. When I was looking up for this to search up what endangered species to talk about, there I found out there's an endangered species in 2019. See, it's already still happening. We just don't know it. I didn't even hear of this animal until I looked this up. It was a Chinese paddlefish. It was one of the largest freshwater fish, and it was officially declared extinct by IUCN in 2019. Do you think this is normal? It is a reality. Like, many species are going extinct today, and the more endangered they become, the more closer they become to extinction. So I want you guys to think about it. Try spreader wood. Think of your favorite animal. Mine is the panda. It was endangered. It still is, but not as much as it was before because of the efforts. Another one I can think of off the top of my head, orangutan. That was my favorite one to do on the podcast. That they're endangered. They still are, but there are so many efforts to help them now. I'm getting a bit emotional. There are many animals that are going extinct. There are many endangered animals in our wildlife. You might not think you're able to do something, but just spreading the word helps. Just listening to this and sharing this podcast also helps. But I guess this is the end for me, you guys. It's the end. Oh man, it's only been like 19 minutes of recording this. I feel bad, you guys. This is my final episode. Well, I hope you guys enjoy my podcast. I hope you guys enjoy your time. I wish luck to all future students. And I definitely recommend you guys join Radio Laurie because it's been a fun time. This has been Faded Tales, a series about animals at risk of disappearing and what their stories can tell us while they're still here. Thank you for being a part of this journey, and thank you for listening. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.